The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and/or print impaired. Hello, this is Evan Mercer from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the January 1st, 2018 edition of the New Yorker magazine. First, I'll read an article from the Talk of the Town section called Kebab Quandary. This will be followed by an article from the Profiles section entitled The Virtuoso, A Tech Pioneer's Unexpected Last Act. And finally, I will read the movie review, which reviews two movies, Downsizing and Happy End. So, let's get started. Brave New World, Kebab Quandary. On a recent off day for the New York Knicks, Enes Kanter, the team's gifted new center who moved to the United States from Turkey 8 years ago, was at the White Plains Ritz-Carlton trying to decide if it was safe for him to go out for halal kebabs. Kanter is 6 feet 11, with manicured facial hair that makes him look older than his 25 years, until he smiles, which he does often. The Knicks had just practiced at their training facility in Tarrytown, and Kanter had showered and changed into clean sweats. There was a halal joint called Turkish Cuisine down the block, but Kanter was hesitant. I don't know if it's a my Turkish people Turkish restaurant or a their Turkish people Turkish restaurant, he said, sitting in the lobby. It could be a problem. Kanter is an outspoken critic of Recep Tayyip Erdogan, Turkey's increasingly authoritarian president. On Twitter, he has called Erdogan the Hitler of our century. In person, he rattles off stats on Erdogan's rollback of civil liberties since a July 2016 coup attempt against him. Quote, there have been more than 60,000 people jailed, he said. Turkey is number one at putting reporters in jail. Civilian critics are silenced, too. If you go to Turkey and you try to check my Twitter, it says banned. Kanter's parents and sister are still in Turkey, but he has not talked with them since the coup. I cannot communicate with my family, he said, explaining that government censors listen to everything. Last summer, Kanter's father denounced him in the Turkish press, saying, quote, with a feeling of shame, I apologize to our president and the Turkish people for having such a son, end quote. Kanter says the comment was coerced. My dad has to say a thing like that. If he wouldn't say it, he'd be in jail right now. Last spring, during the Knicks' off-season, Kanter had plans to hold youth basketball clinics in 16 countries, a bit of charitable globetrotting that was to include, he said, stops in Philippines, Tokyo, Korea, the good one, not the crazy one, and then a visit to Europe to see the Papa. He grabbed his phone and scrolled through his Twitter feed until he came to @Pontifex. Pope! He smiled and went on with the story. So we landed in Indonesia. We had our clinic. Everything was cool. At around 2:30 a.m., his manager knocked on his hotel room door. He told me the Army and Intelligence Service had come to the school where we had just had the clinic. He said the Turkish government called Indonesia and told them, Enes Kanter? He's a dangerous man. Recalling that night, Kanter arched his eyebrows, still befuddled. He'd made a split-second decision and told his manager, we should escape this country right now. They caught the next flight, a 5:30 a.m. to Singapore, then continued to Romania, hoping to resume the clinics. I gave my passport to this lady at the Bucharest airport, and she said, your passport is canceled. You cannot get into this country. She referred him to a police officer. So I'm like, what's the reason? And the policeman said, it's a secret. Kanter decided to head back to New York via London. At the gate at Heathrow, Kanter said, there was this gentleman waiting from U.S. Homeland Security. He asked for my green card, took some notes, and he said, okay, you're good to go. And I was like, oh, man, now we're safe. Cantor joined the Knicks in September as part of the trade that sent Carmelo Anthony to the Oklahoma City Thunder. He'd been beloved in Oklahoma, where he and a close friend, the hirsute Kiwi bruiser Stephen Adams, became known as the Stach Brothers. Still, Cantor was thrilled about the trade. "Before, I could reach out to like a million people," he said. "In New York, I can reach out to 100 million. I have even a stronger voice, so I need to use it." After the passport incident, Cantor said his family's home in Istanbul was raided by the police for electronics. "They wanted to see if I'm still in contact." And his father was jailed for 5 days. "I get death threats. I don't know if I should take them seriously," he said, sighing. Then the smile came back. "Well, you never know. Erdogan is a crazy man." In New York, Cantor said it's time to know how Turkish immigrants will react to him. He is leery of unfamiliar Turkish restaurants. "You could go to a place and find it's run by a president supporter," he said, "and they might just kick me out." Finally, he headed out to Case Turkish Cuisine. He stood across the street from the restaurant, a plain storefront with a giant fork and spoon on the sign. "So this is the place," he said, squinting. "I don't want to get too close. I still don't know. Is it my Turkish or somebody else's Turkish?" After a minute, he turned toward the hotel. "I'll take you to a Turkish restaurant in the city," he said. "The one I know on 57th Street? It's really, really good." But reached by telephone later, the owner of a Turkish cuisine, Apo Kilik, who is Kurdish, dismissed Cantor's apprehensions. "He's more than welcome to come," he said. "He can say anything he wants." And now, from the profile section, I'll read The Virtuoso, A Tech Pioneer's Unexpected Last Act, by James B. Stewart. Johannes Brahms wrote his first violin sonata for his muse, the pianist Clara Schumann. He presented it to her in 1879, soon after the death of her youngest child, Felix, who was named for the composer Felix Mendelssohn and was the only violinist among Schumann's 8 children. Brahms was his godfather. The sonata, which Brahms completed at the relatively late age of 46, takes its theme from his own Regenlied, or Rain Song, and it is a meditation on the loss of childhood innocence. The violinist, Anne Sophie Mutter, who was captivated by the work as a child, has said that it is best played by an adult. Quote, "I have a deeper understanding of music, and if you want it or not, life does not leave its marks not only in your brain, but in your heart and in your soul," she said. "The understanding of things deepens." Eric's son heard the Brahms piece at a violin summer camp when he was in junior high. He'd started playing on a child-sized instrument at the age of 4, and although he didn't really enjoy the lessons, he stuck with them, mostly to please his parents. Son's father, Ming Ting's son, and his mother, Julie, were immigrants from Taiwan who went to the University of Texas at Arlington in 1980 and later settled in New Jersey. Ming Ting is a video processing researcher. Julie is a certified public accountant. Eric was an only child until he was 11, when his sister was born. By the age of 3, he could recite lengthy Chinese poems from the calligraphy scrolls that hung in his home. In 4th grade, he asked to study the piano, and his teacher discovered that he had perfect pitch. When he was in 7th grade, his parents, at the suggestion of his teacher, took him to a violin dealer in Manhattan who had a Stradivarius but wouldn't let him touch it. Son tried several instruments before choosing one that cost $6,500. It was a financial stretch for his parents, but his father told me, education is always the top priority in our culture. In 1996, when Son was 13, his father joined the faculty of the University of Washington, and the family moved to the Seattle area. Sun was placed in a program for students with IQs over 140. Though slight of build, he was on the varsity tennis team. He also excelled at ping pong. But he missed his friends in New Jersey and was slow to make new ones. Other students taunted him as a nerd. Sun started taking lessons from Kyung Chi, a violinist with the Seattle Symphony and the Seattle Opera Orchestra. Chi told me that Sun displayed remarkable technical facility, but she often found herself urging him, sometimes even shouting at him, to play with more emotion. In 2001, as Sun's high school graduation approached, he asked Chi if he could play the Brahms Sonata for a senior recital. She thought there were few works more ill-suited to Sun, and her response was swift and direct, "Absolutely not." This fall, I visited Sun and his wife, Karen Law, at their apartment in Mountain View, California, and Sun recalled Chi's response. He told me that he'd thought he would give up playing after graduating from high school. He pursued computer science instead and joined Facebook in 2008, 4 years after it was founded. At 33, he had had the kind of remarkable career that makes Silicon Valley a subject of persistent fascination and envy. I had first seen Sun a few months earlier at a chamber music program at Stanford University, which I attended as an amateur pianist. He was still slight of build, with a shock of dark hair, and looked younger than his age. I didn't know then that about a year before, he had been given a diagnosis of glioblastoma, an aggressive brain cancer, and might have only months to live. He was already making plans to give away the rare violin I'd heard him play. In addition to his gifts for music and math, I later learned he had an entrepreneurial streak. As a teenager, he taught himself computer programming and started a web hosting business, Alpha Python Technologies, which he incorporated in 2000 and sold after enrolling at Stanford. There, he embarked on a double major in computer science and economics, and joined the orchestra. He met Sean Tyan, a fellow student who took many of the same classes, and like Sun, was the child of Asian immigrant parents and played the violin. The two became best friends, and during the spring break of their junior year, Sun, Tyan, and another friend visited Berlin, where they went to a concert featuring the young American violin prodigy Hilary Hahn. Tyan described Sun as having been enthralled by Hahn's performance of Eric Korngold's Violin Concerto in D Major, which none of them had heard before. The flashy, crowd-pleasing work foreshadows the popular film scores of John Williams, who wrote the soundtrack to E.T. and Star Wars. Watching Hahn, Sun told me he realized for the first time, quote, how much fun playing the violin could be. After the concert, he bought a Hahn CD in the lobby and waited in line for her to autograph it. He became an avid follower of her blog and read up on the instrument she used, a violin made in 1864 by a noted French craftsman and violin dealer, Jean-Baptiste Vion. Back at Stanford, Sun started studying with Dawn Harms, a member of the music faculty, who was a co-concertmaster of the Oakland Symphony and a member of the San Francisco Opera Orchestra. Harms recalled, "Eric could sight-read anything, and he has natural technique. But how do you emotionally move people through your playing? That's what we had to work on. Some people can do it, and some can't." During Sun's senior year, a friend persuaded him to enroll in Social Dances of North America. Sun had never danced, but his musical background helped him with rhythm and with memorizing steps. After mastering the basics of the waltz, the polka, and swing, he joined the committee that organizes Stanford's Viennese Ball, an annual white tie event. Each year, members of the committee perform an elaborately choreographed waltz to open the dance. In this group, he found a warm sense of community that had long eluded him, and forged lasting friendships. Sun graduated with honors in 2005, but his grade point average in computer science was below 3. He had got a B- in the course taught by Jerry Kane, the software engineer who created Facebook's Like feature. He looked for a job as a computer programmer, but he was repeatedly rejected and ended up working at an economic consulting firm. He stayed on in the Stanford Orchestra and helped audition new members of the ball committee. And the following year, one candidate caught his eye. She moved like a ballerina, Sun remembered. Quote, her form was very different from everyone else, which isn't usually regarded as a good thing, end quote. Well, it was Karen Law, who had just completed a master's degree in thermosciences, a branch of mechanical engineering. She was one of the few women in the field. The year's waltz choreographers paired her and Sun. Law had begun studying the violin at the age of 6, and she and Sun discussed what Law refers to as, quote, the Asian arms race. Your child plays either the violin or the piano, and preferably both. Then they have to be properly equipped with the best instrument, end quote. The goals are to instill self-discipline and a work ethic, to get into a top college, and to confer bragging rights on the parents. Law was one of 3 girls, and unlike Sun, had felt no pressure from her parents to play an instrument. She told Sun, my parents always said things like, don't do this to impress us. Law's career goal as a mechanical engineer was to advance the cause of clean energy. Sun's attitude, she recalled, was, that's a nice thing to work toward, but he didn't see much evidence of it happening. After the Viennese ball, Law told me, she and Sun realized that they couldn't bear to be apart. A few months later, Sun was driving to an orchestra rehearsal when Law called him to say that a small lump near her throat had been diagnosed as thyroid cancer. Sun turned around and drove to her apartment. Law had a dose of radiation therapy that kept her in isolation for 2 weeks. She told only family members and close friends about her condition. Sun and Law didn't call attention to the relationship either. They lived in separate apartments while Law worked on a clean energy research at the Sandia National Laboratories in Livermore, and Sun pursued a master's degree in statistics at Stanford. His friend Tyan said he knew that they were serious only after he went backpacking with them in Big Sur in 2008. In 2009, Sun did not mention to Tyan that he was planning to propose. At the Viennese ball that year, Sun carried an engagement ring in the pocket of his tailcoat. He and Law won a waltz competition, and he momentarily thought of dropping to his knee during the prize giving. Instead, he proposed the next day. He and Law were married in August 2010 in a small ceremony in Half Moon Bay, a resort town south of San Francisco. They choreographed a dance for the occasion, set to Glenn Miller's In the Mood. When midway through his master's, Sun applied to the summer internship at Facebook, then based in Palo Alto, and he was surprised to get the position. As an intern, Sun met Mark Zuckerberg at a Facebook hackathon, one of the company's all-night coding sessions, at which it was traditional to serve Chinese food at 10 p.m. Hey, I'm Mark, Zuckerberg said, extending his hand. Sun liked the egalitarian nature of the early Facebook. One of his favorite adages was, nothing at Facebook is somebody else's problem. Sun's first project was a paper examining how information spreads on Facebook, comparing it to how viruses spread contagious diseases. It was important work in the nascent era of social networking, with implications about how public opinion is formed and how advertising and marketing messages circulate. Sun described the paper as the first study of a large number of real contagion events on a social network that accurately captures the genuine social ties that exist between people in the world, real world, end quote. It won the main prize at that year's International Conference on Web Logs and Social Media. In 2009, after Sun finished his master's, Facebook hired him permanently. He joined a project called Entities, which mapped and organized connections between a user and pretty much everything else, movies, restaurants, books. Sun embraced the company's mission of, quote, making the world more open and connected, end quote, and Law Notice became as idealistic about his work as she was about hers. He often shrugged off criticism of Facebook, paraphrasing Zuckerberg, quote, we're never as good as people say we are, and we're never as bad, end quote. Years later, as Facebook came under increasing scrutiny for distributing fake news and hate speech and for enabling Russian interference in the 2016 election, Sun acknowledged to me that there were, quote, huge problems, but he remained upbeat. Sun felt that his credentials and skills were modest compared with those of the engineers and programmers he worked with, but he earned glowing performance reviews. Every once in a while, he wondered about his company's shares. Would it be phenomenal if they turned out to be worth something? In 2012, Facebook went public. Within 2 years, its stock price had doubled. In 2014, Sun was made a manager, a big step at a company where most people are referred to as, quote, ICs, or, quote, individual contributors. The same year, Facebook asked Sun to move to London and create a new team to work on entities. Law got a job there as a manager at another fast-growing software company. Sun told me that he approached management the way he did chamber music, leading while listening, like the first violinist in a string quartet. To help foster a sense of collegiality, Sun and Law invited members of Sun's team to take a ballroom dance lesson together. There were more men than women in the group, and people recall Sun dancing with some of the men who didn't have partners. Sun and Law lived 3 blocks east of Wigmore Hall, a chamber music venue, and near the city's violin dealers and auction houses, including Brompton's and Teresio. The demands of Sun's work at Facebook left little time for music, but he would sometimes drop by a showroom to try out instruments. Rare violins sell for hundreds of thousands of dollars, or even, in some cases, millions. In 2011, Teresio set an auction record, $15.9 million, with the sale of the, quote, Lady Blunt Stradivarius, which had belonged to Lady Anne Blunt, the granddaughter of Lord Byron. On a visit to the Teresio showroom, Sun met Carlos Tomei, Teresio's co-owner and the head of sales. Tomei listened to Sun play and promised to watch out for a violin made by Vuillaume, like the one Sun had heard Hilary Hahn play. I loved the tone of her instrument, Sun told me. Vuillaume sold instruments to Niccolo Paganini and other leading violinists of his day. According to David Schoenbaum's book, The Violin, his workshop produced more than 3,000 violins. He was a prize winner at the Great Exhibition in London in 1851 and was awarded the Medal of the French Legion of Honor. Vuillaume bought and sold many of the best instruments made by the early Italian masters, and his copies of Stradivarius and Guarneri violins are highly sought after. In 2016, Teresio told Sun the Vuillaume Guarneri copy was coming up for sale in London. Most violins have backs that are made with two pieces of wood glued together, but this one had a single piece back, a feature that's coveted for aesthetic reasons. The violin, like Hahn's, was made in the middle of the 19th century. As soon as Sun played it, he knew that it was for him. The sound was warm, bright but not too bright. It was exactly what I was looking for. Tomei told me that many violinists liken their relationship with their instrument to a marriage. There's a deep level of intimacy, he said. The violin is made of wood. It vibrates. It responds to the emotions you pour into it. It's moody, just like humans. Still, Tomei recalled, Sun was, quote, very analytical, very professional in his approach. He made 3 visits to the showroom and then returned with Law. They took 2 violins into a private room. Law played each while Sun tried to tell the difference. As a test, she sometimes played the same violin twice. Sun consistently identified the Vuillaume. He paid just over $200,000 for the instrument. In all likelihood, Sun got a bargain. In 2003, Teresio sold a Vuillaume owned by the late virtuoso Isaac Stern for $141,000. a record for Vuillaume at the time, and resold it 10 years later for $250,000. In a recent private sale, another Vuillaume sold for close to $400,000. The prices of violins may have leveled off over certain periods, Schoenbaum told me, but so far as anyone can tell, they've never gone down. When Tyan visited Sun, and Law soon afterward, Sun showed off the violin and sheepishly told Tyan what he had paid for it. I was shocked, Tyan said. He and Karen were always so frugal. He said, it's an investment. Diversifies your asset portfolio beyond stocks and bonds. Son-in-law spent 2 years in London and then returned to California, renting the Mountain View apartment, a modest one-bedroom. They thought of themselves as a typical Silicon Valley couple. They hiked, biked, kayaked, and camped. They followed a low-carb, ketogenic diet, and they tried to minimize their carbon footprint. In London, Son had experienced periodic bouts of nausea. Blood tests had showed nothing unusual. The symptoms persisted in California, and a doctor suggested a brain MRI, which she described as pro forma, given Son's youth and good health. After the scan, however, the doctor suggested that he see a neurosurgeon right away. The neurosurgeon found a growth in Son's brain which looked like a malignant kind of tumor that might be difficult to remove. The surgeon recommended a biopsy. Son texted Tyan and called family members and close friends. Law had been discreet about her thyroid cancer, but she and Son decided to be as open as possible about his diagnosis, which Law described as a burden that simply can't be borne alone. Son broke the news on Facebook. Quote, I'm sorry I wasn't able to tell everyone personally. Please excuse the mass blast, he wrote. Yesterday afternoon, I was diagnosed with a brain tumor. A few days later, during a weekly meeting that Zuckerberg holds for the company, Sun joined him on stage and said that he'd be taking a medical leave. He recounted how Zuckerberg had introduced himself when they first met, even though Sun had known who he was. I look forward to seeing you when you come back, Zuckerberg said. Tom Stocky, then a Facebook vice president, said, all of us just wanted to believe, oh, this is a thing that sounds scarier than it really is. Few of Sun's colleagues had encountered a problem they didn't think could be solved through technology. Shortly after Sun received his diagnosis, Zuckerberg and his wife, Priscilla Chan, pledged $3 billion to, quote, cure, prevent, or manage disease, all disease, within a generation. Sun's surgery on September 22, 2016, removed as much of the tumor as possible, and he began courses of chemotherapy and radiation. His mental capacities and physical dexterities were unaffected, but the pathology report from doctors at Stanford was grim. The tumor was an astrocytoma. Low-grade astrocytomas tend to be slow-growing and contained, but a grade 4 astrocytoma, called a glioblastoma, is a ruthlessly aggressive cancer that has struck, among others, Vice President Joe Biden's son, Beau, and Senator John McCain. Glioblastomas are resistant to treatment and are almost always deemed incurable because they inevitably recur, usually in the same place. The doctors at the University of California, San Francisco, who also analyzed the tissue, said that Sun's life expectancy could be as short as 14 months. Sun had largely kept his emotions in check, but hearing this, he wept. After the surgery, Sun suffered intense pain, but insisted that he didn't need any medication. One evening, he found Law crying on the balcony of their apartment in a rare outburst of frustration. If you won't help yourself, no one else can, she said. He started a list, quote, how to help myself. And on it he wrote, quote, keep communicating with Karen, even if they are darker thoughts. On October 20th, a few days before his 33rd birthday, Sun wrote in a Facebook post, it's been hard to come to grips with having aggressive and incurable grade 4 brain cancer. It's been hard not to get angry and sad about it. It's been frustrating that every pathology test after my surgery came back with the worst possible result. and it's been hard to accept that modern medicine isn't able to fix me. At the same time, he wrote, "Every day I wake up not dead is a gift." Son-in-law had other lists detailing the things that they had hoped to accomplish in life, a habit that Law had acquired while working as a counselor at a science camp. Son's list included a trip to Wimbledon, climbing Mount Snowdon in Wales, and a range of musical aspirations, from learning the Bach sonatas and partitas to performing the first violin part in Mendelssohn's Octet in E-flat major. The Viomme violin had fulfilled one of these goals. Inspired by Hilary Hahn, who has spoken often of her devotion to Bach, Sun started working on Bach's six sonatas and partitas for unaccompanied violin, the most difficult parts of which George Enescu, a celebrated violinist from Romania, has described as the Himalayas for violinists. Sun practiced every day, even if he could only manage 15 minutes between medical treatments. As he mastered each piece, he posted his performances on Facebook. He finished on November 12th, then turned to the even more difficult Paganini Caprices, a set of 24 etudes, which he had often listened to in a recording by Itzhak Perlman. "It's something I've always wanted to play when I grew up, like wanting to be a great baseball player," he said. As he practiced, Sun told me his new violin felt like a good friend. The caprices were so difficult that he resumed lessons with Harms, his college teacher. "I hadn't seen him since he graduated," she said. "He was this hot shot at Facebook. He had a beautiful wife. He was dancing. He had the perfect life. And then he told me, 'I guess you haven't heard.'" In January, Sun applied for the St. Lawrence String Quartet's annual chamber music seminar at Stanford. The renowned ensemble, founded in Canada, has been in residence at the university for 19 years. The seminar mixes young professionals with accomplished amateurs, and admission is competitive. It was something Sun had long wanted to do, but he had never found the time. Sun was accepted, and 3 days later, he disclosed his diagnosis to Leslie Robertson, the violist in the quartet, who was overseeing applications. She assured him that his place was secure. The Mendelssohn Octet was high on Sun's list of musical goals, and he contacted the members of the group he was assigned, encouraging them to choose the piece, which requires 8 skilled string players, 4 violins, 2 violas, and 2 cellos. Mendelssohn wrote it in 1825 when he was 16. He intended it as a birthday gift for his violin teacher, and the first violin part requires virtuosic skill. The masterpiece has echoes of Mendelssohn's predecessors Mozart and Schubert. Like both of them, Mendelssohn died young, at 38, apparently from a brain hemorrhage. At around the same time that Sun was accepted for the seminar, Law learned that the Sunnyvale Community Players, a local theater group, was mounting a production of Fiddler on the Roof that would run from late September into early October. Law remembered that in the movie version, quote, "there's an awesome violin cadenza," written by John Williams, who reorchestrated much of Jerry Bach's original Broadway score. This could satisfy 2 more of Sun's goals, playing as the concertmaster in an orchestra and playing what amounted to a concerto with an orchestra. The show's music director told Law that he'd never been able to find an amateur violinist who could play it, given its high-speed runs and enormous range. Williams wrote the part for Isaac Stern. Law asked him to send Sun the music. In May, after 10 days of practice, Sun auditioned and got the part. Sun begged his doctors to keep him alive and healthy enough to perform the solo in October. Given his resources and contacts, Sun had access to experimental treatments for brain cancer, but he and Law decided that they'd stay in California rather than spend their time traveling to distant medical centers. He did enroll in a clinical trial at Stanford that required threading a plastic tube through his right arm into his heart, which meant he couldn't use his bow for 4 weeks. He took the opportunity, however, to strengthen his left hand and to practice left-handed pizzicato, a plucking technique required for the Paganini caprices. Otherwise, he had the standard treatment with the usual side effects of nausea and fatigue. At an appointment in mid-June, Sun's doctor told him, and Law, that a new tumor had formed in Sun's brain and that tumors had spread to his spine. They were inoperable. Sun abruptly left the doctor's office, followed by Law. "This is it, isn't it?" he whispered to her. Sun and Law gathered their close friends at the apartment. Tian told me that as soon as he arrived, he could sense that there was bad news. After hearing it, we realized he wasn't going to be one of the lucky ones, Tian said. The group asked questions about the treatment options, and Sun tried to lighten the mood, noting that things could be worse. During radiation treatments for the tumors on his spine, unlike the ones for his brain, he could at least move his head a little. He went around talking to all of us, asking, "How can I make my passing easier for you?" Tian recalled. Tian found himself pondering the lessons of a humanities course he and Sun had taken, called Visions of Morality, which asked, "Is death bad for a person? And if so, why?" He thought about a quote from Epicurus, quote, "When we exist, death is not present, and when death is present, we do not exist," end quote. Though he didn't find it especially comforting. Law, too, struggled with feelings of helplessness. She wrote to me that although she'd tried to conceal it from Sun, she'd often cried in childishness when things were so easy with Eric as a partner, suddenly had to be carried alone by me, in frustration at no longer having certain choices in my life, in anguish, knowing that there's more suffering to come in Eric's final days, in uncertainty, knowing that the challenge of rebuilding my life still awaits me. Son-in-law had already talked about how to distribute his wealth and what he wanted done in his memory. They endowed a scholarship at Stanford for women in the STEM fields and offered financial aid for applicants to the Chamber Music Seminar. The day after Sun received the news that the tumor had returned, he wrote to Tomei about the Viom violin. He knew that Tarisio offered grants to young artists and suggested that one of the prizes be the use of his violin for a year. Tomei had been closely following Sun's Facebook posts. "I almost wish I didn't know about his pain, but at the same time, I couldn't look away from it," he said. "Could he get to the next Paganini caprice? Would he make it?" Tomei was humbled by Sun's suggestion that he donate his violin. "I think a top promising young violinist should be so lucky to play on your instrument, and we can certainly arrange for this," he immediately replied. That same day, the Chamber Music Seminar began. Telling his group that he was still in shock, Sun disclosed the latest developments. He had to reschedule only one rehearsal to accommodate his treatment regime, which included renewed radiation. Toward the end of the seminar, Robertson described Sun's situation to some young participants to help them recognize, quote, that making music can literally be a matter of life and death, end quote, as she told me. "And even when it's not life and death in the strictest sense, it should feel like it's life and death. That profound moment of making music that takes you to another world is something we're very privileged to experience." Most of us in the seminar knew nothing of Sun's condition. When we gathered at the final recital at Stanford's Campbell Recital Hall, the room, which is meant to hold a little more than 200 people, was packed beyond capacity. And there was a sense of outsized anticipation that was hard to understand. The recital opened with the Mendelssohn Octet, a work filled with the exuberant optimism of youth. The spirited performance drew a thunderous ovation. Quite a few people were wiping away tears. Some were sobbing. Puzzled at the extreme reaction, I turned to a violinist next to me, and she explained. It was Carlos Tomei, a friend with whom I frequently play chamber music, who introduced me to Sun. I scheduled a trip to California in September, hoping to see his fiddler performance. He urged me to come early in the run. In late July, Sun drove to Seattle to visit his parents and for a lesson on the Fiddler Passages with Kyung Chi, his high school teacher, who had joined Facebook in order to follow his medical progress. Sun had the notes of the Condesa in his fingers, Chi said, but she pressed him to be more emotional.
Let's back off the technical aspect, she told him. It's the slow notes that are more challenging. It's basically a Yiddish melody. Very heartfelt.
By the third or fourth time through, he was playing differently. She admired the violin and lent him her bow, made by Francois Nicolas Forin, who was Vuillaume's cousin and who worked in the Vuillaume workshop. At the end of their lesson, Sun reminded her that when he was in high school, she wouldn't let him play the Brahms sonata. She paused, suddenly overcome. You can play the Brahms now, she said. Tian, too, had detected a significant change in Sun's playing.
Some of it might be the confidence of playing on such a nice violin, he said. Plus, he's practicing an hour a day. He'd spent so much time and energy working, and now music fills that void.
During the run-up to Fiddler, Sun was taking two lessons a week from Harms, even when he had to squeeze them in between radiation sessions. In the past, Sun had criticized the violin superstar Joshua Bell for over-emoting. But now he studied videos of Bell and incorporated some of his theatrical moves and body language. He and Law called it Jay Belling. Quote, he was trying to convey his own personal story and the story of the fiddler, Law said. He pushed the boundary of what he felt comfortable with. In contrast with his playing as a college student, Harms said, he's really starting to communicate something deeper. I've been blown away. When I met Sun and Law at their apartment, I hadn't seen Sun since the seminar, though we'd been talking regularly. He'd lost weight, most of the sight in his right eye was gone, and much of his dark hair had fallen out. He said he'd been struggling with nausea and short-term memory loss. A few weeks earlier, he'd had radiation to shrink some tumors on his spine, close to his neck, which were threatening the nerves that control the arms and the fingers. The radiation made him dangerously susceptible to sunburn, and when we walked down the street for lunch at a health food cafe, he wore heavy dark glasses, a black scarf around his neck, and a large safari-style hat. His doctors had been wary of his taking on a role as demanding as the one in Fiddler. He had to walk and play at the same time, which was difficult with his impaired sight and depth perception. The orchestra had worked out a plan to cover for him should he suffer any sudden problems on stage. Law and Tyson sensed that, given the importance he attached to Fiddler, his decline might accelerate once the play was over. 6 weeks after the last performance, he went into hospice care, and less than 48 hours later, died in Law's arms. It was November 23rd, 14 months after he received his diagnosis. On the afternoon of my visit in September, Sun carefully removed his Vuillaume violin from its velvet-lined case and showed me its single-piece back. He'd made it through 15 of the 24 Paganini Caprices. He asked me to select a Bach solo partita movement at random, an exercise, he said, that kept him from playing only his favorites. I picked the Bourrée from the first partita in B minor, which he dispatched despite its difficult triple and quadruple stops, three or four notes played at once. He had me follow the score as he practiced his fiddler solos from memory. Then he suggested we play something together. I went to the upright piano, which he'd had tuned for my visit, and he handed me the score for Brahms' first violin sonata. Law recorded as we played. I arrived early for that night's performance. The program included a brief biography of Sun and described his violin. Quote, due to an incurable brain cancer, this production of The Fiddler on the Roof will be his final set of public performances, the note read. Thereafter, his violin will be loaned to the Teresio Trust, Eric Sun Karen Law Vuillaume Fellowship. As the show opened, Sun entered at the back of the auditorium, in costume as the fiddler. His cap covered his scalp. The dim lighting concealed his damaged eye. He made his way down to a set of shallow steps onto the semi-darkened stage while playing the haunting opening solo. After intermission, the orchestra played the Williams film music, and Sun rose from his seat in the orchestra and moved to center stage. He launched into the cadenza, playing with a passion and virtuosity I hadn't heard him play with before. He blazed through the runs and easily landed the highest notes. When he finished, there was a standing ovation, even as the orchestra resumed. Sun smiled, acknowledging the applause. Then he blew a kiss to the crowd, and the spotlight dimmed. Well, for something a little lighter, we have the current cinema movie review called Small Worlds, Downsizing and Happy End by Anthony Lane. The hero of Downsizing is called Paul Safranek, Matt Damon, and the clumsy name befits him. He stresses the first syllable, but everyone else stresses the second, with a long A. The mismatch proves to Paul that the world doesn't really get him. He's a drab and decent fellow from Omaha who dreamed of being a surgeon but wound up as an occupational therapist. We see him tending to a sick mother and then, 10 years later, living with his healthy wife, Audrey, Kristen Wiig. Nothing much has changed except that a bit more energy has leaked out of him. So how about making a change? Why don't he and Audrey downsize, not move house or cut down on sugary snacks, that is, but reduce themselves to 0.0364 of their original mass and volume? Why not live large by turning small? Such is the delightful premise of Alexander Payne's new film. From the opening scene in a Norwegian laboratory, we realize that the necessary science is up and running. Moreover, its ethical basis is sound. Given that the planet is overpopulated, we are told, quote, the one practical, humane, and lasting solution to humanity's greatest problem is to give some of those humans, volunteers only, such a magical zapping that an entire family can be born around in a cat basket. The average male will contract to 13 centimeters or so, along the lines of a full-grown parsnip. And nobody is more average than Paul. He is the credible shrinking man. Downsizing is not an update of Honey, I Shrunk the Kids. Anyone hoping to see Paul go mano a mano with a chihuahua will be frustrated. Most of the time, the itsy-bitsy teeny-weenies do not dwell among us. Instead, they are housed in places like Leisureland, a vast biodome, self-enclosed and self-sustaining, to which the Safraneks travel for miniaturization. When they decided to undergo it, we never learn. For some reason, Payne elides that crucial exchange. The funniest and strangest parts of the film show the process in persnickety detail. The shaving of all body hair, including eyebrows, gastric irrigation, and the extraction of the teeth, later to be replaced by mini-snappers. There's a wonderful image just after the zapping of regular-sized technicians entering the room and scooping up each naked, sedated, and freshly shriveled form with a spatula as if they were flipping burgers. Paul might as well be a slab of meat. Then he wakes up, probes his mouth with his tongue, checks his groin, and becomes a sentient character again. Once he is ensconced in Leisureland, something curious happens, gratifying to fans of Payne's earlier films such as Election, 1999, and The Descendants, 2011, yet disappointing in the light of the fantastical setup that he has labored on this occasion to construct. Downsizing turns, first, into a regulation social satire, making easy if queasy fun of our taste for sunlit success. One of Paul's acquaintances, who went small before him, greets him at a pool party with the mantra, "Look around you, buddy, life is good." Most consumer products, we are informed, are enticingly cheap on the far side of the procedure, and $152,000 in equity swells to $12.5 million. But would the microeconomy not just adjust accordingly? Then comes an epiphany. Paul discovers a shanty town on the rim of leisure land where the tiny poor have established their own community. They strike him as less phony than the gated set among whom he resides, and he finds himself, pretty much by accident, becoming a dog's body to Ngoc Lan Tran, Hong Chau, a young Vietnamese woman with a wooden leg. And still pain is not done. Paul and his new friend travel to Norway, where the movie began, and join a utopian adventure, a village of the downsized, whose inhabitants aim to establish a subterranean home where they will, over generations, set out the ecological death and renaissance of Earth. We've come a long way from Omaha. This is touching and unorthodox stuff. Paine has not struck an apocalyptic note before, and Paul's transformation from a mousy dullard to a visionary who plays bongo drums at sunset beside a fjord is one that maybe only Damon could handle. Just one question. Where'd the smallness go? Almost everything that befalls the hero in the latter half of downsizing might equally befall a normal six-footer with a hazy political conscience. So what's the point of his diminution? The film, having launched a sprightly comic conceit, lets it glide away. The comparison here is with Swift, who was out to belittle mankind. Barely for a moment, in the first two sections of Gulliver's Travels, does he let us forget that small is interesting only in relation to big. Paine has a nice gag about Paul's wedding ring, which he is permitted to take to Leisureland, where it looks as massive as a life preserver. But there are pages of Swift that can boast half a dozen gags as inventive as that, and he's markedly less prim. Think of Gulliver in Lilliput, extinguishing a fire in the royal palace with a jet of urine, or of the frolicsome girl of 16 in Brobdingnag, who would, quote, sometimes set me astride upon one of her nipples with many other tricks. Gulliver, now being the size of Paul, and ripe for use as a sex toy. The only person in the film who could dare to imagine such a jest is Dusan, Christopher Waltz, a Serbian sybarite and wheeler dealer who lives in an apartment above Paul's in Leisureland. Waltz's wicked grin, as Paul opens the door, shakes up this placid and well-behaved tale. And Dusan's belief that people are basically patsies and prudes, Swift wouldn't disagree, allows him to treat the whole business of downsizing not as an environmental imperative, but as a chance for commercial scams. As such, he threatens the movie's ethical zeal and is promptly shunted to the fringes of the story. Likewise, we hear in passing of undocumented mini-migrants and of terrorists who are forcibly downsized, as if sent into exile. But those fascinating ideas go largely unexplored. A less tasteful director might have reveled in the danger, the venom, and the sheer fun to be had in the kingdom of the pint size. Whereas Paine, ever scrupulous, is more attentive to minor acts of kindness than to the proportions of the folk who perform them. As for Paul, you can't help feeling that ground down as he was, he didn't need to get shrunk in the first place. He needed a shrink. The new Michael Haneke film, Happy End, is set in the Calais region of northern France, where the Laurents are a clan to be reckoned with. Thomas, Mathieu Kassovitz, is a surgeon. His sister Anne, Isabelle Huppert, oversees the family's construction company. She hoped to be succeeded by her son, Pierre, Franz Rogowski, but he is a wastrel. After Thomas's former wife attempts suicide, their daughter Eve, Fantine Hardwin, age 13, comes to live with her father, who is now married to Anai, Laura Verlinden. They have a baby son, for whose safety you fear. There is also a sizable dog whose bite is worse than his bark. They all dwell in a mansion with a marble hall, waited upon by Rashid, Hassam Ghansi and Jamila Nabiga Akari. At the heart of the house is Georges, Jean-Louis Trintignant, the elderly father of Thomas and Anne, who longs to die. He crashes his car into a tree, but merely breaks a few bones. At his age, they must snap like twigs. This being a Haneke project, there is plenty to freak us out. He likes to lock into a single composition, holding steady and testing our patience to the brink. And only then will a surprise be sprung. Haneke is rightly obsessed, too, with the way in which we have all become filmmakers. Happy End is topped and tailed by creepy cell phone footage, compelling us to ask what it means to capture an event on our screens. Are we really treating it as something to keep and even to treasure? Or are we innately cruel, trapping others' lives in the wild and mocking the results like zoo-goers poking through the bars? By Haneke's standards, however, Happy End feels stuck, at times indeed close to a pastiche. The fact that misery can chill and rot the rich like a spiritual frostbite is hardly news. And if you set a movie in Calais, a corner of Europe into which so many refugees have poured, why make such sketchy use of their plight? Pierre, eager to vex his mother, brings a group of them to a celebrity lunch that she is hosting. But the movie itself has paid them little heed. They exist purely to embarrass the bourgeois. Still, there is always Trintignant, one of the last of the lone wolves in European cinema. As unsparing now as he was in Haneke's Amour, 2012, Kieslowski's Three Colors Red, 1994, and eons ago, Bertolucci's The Conformist, 1970. It is worth seeing Happy End for the long scene between him and the remarkable Fantine Hardin, between the pitiless patriarch and his granddaughter. Together they compare notes on the harm that they have done from generation to generation. The blood runs cold. We have run out of time for today's episode of The New Yorker. I hope you enjoy it and be sure to listen next time. I'm Evan Mercer, reading for the Triangle Radio Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast at our website, triangleReadingService.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. So long until next time.